Okay, good afternoon, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it's February 23rd, and we're still talking about cellular respiration. And before I answer some questions, I got a question for you. What's the whole purpose of cellular respiration? Produce ATP. That's right. We look at all these intricate mechanisms, but don't forget the overall most important overview of that metabolism, and that is to produce ATP. All right, so when you take ATP, or ADP, ADP plus inorganic phosphate, that's going to produce ATP. There is another entity that belongs with this chemical reaction. What's that other entity that goes along with this reaction? Energy. What side of the reaction should energy be on? The left side, right? Right over here. Energy. So what kind of reaction is that? All right, that's an endergonic. So how does your body get this endergonic reaction to take place? It has to couple it with an exergonic reaction. All right, so it's got to run along with an exergonic reaction, and that is what? Respiration. So respiration is a highly exergonic set of metabolic pathways that produces ATP. It's coupled to ATP production. All right, so here, so all of these reactions, glucose going down to pyruvic acid, is that endergonic or exergonic? Right, pyruvic glucose going to pyruvic acid, we see that there's more free energy in glucose compared to pyruvic acid, so that is an exergonic reaction. Glycolysis releases energy. It's exergonic, and what does our metabolism know how to do? Couple the glycolysis with ATP production, which is endergonic. All right, so think of those two little wheels. So this is where we're going to start. Okay, so here's a sign-in sheet, so I'm going to stop just for a second. That's just a little review of what we're doing. And we're scheduled to have a test, I think, a week from today. Okay, well, that's not going to happen. So maybe March 9th, maybe March 11th. That's all I can tell you at this point in time. Okay? So one thing that you can do to help yourself out, we're going to get to the nervous system next time, and you learned a lot about nerves in anatomy. Right, you learned what a sensory neuron looks like, what a motor neuron looks like. So go back and review that, because I might mention it in class, but briefly. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about different kinds of neurons. And also, while you're at it, make sure that you study the different kinds of neuroglia as well. You learn probably what the different neuroglia are by shape and anatomy, and a little bit of the function, but I'll probably treat that pretty lightly, but a whole neuroglia? Glial cells, yeah, glial cells. All right, but I don't want to spend a whole lecture period talking about the functions of those different cells. What we need to be talking about is how a neuron really functions. That's really the hardest thing. So a lot of that you can just review on your own. All right, so I'll get the study guide for the next chapters and the next lecture notes up on Blackboard as soon as I can, maybe even tonight. Okay, so that's all I know about that. So I had a lot of emails when the test was going to be, but I didn't respond because I would just tell everybody in class at the same time. All right, so that's that. But I do believe my recorder is working again. Okay, so does anybody have a question about the respiration that we've covered before? Don't lose sight of the track that these are just what, series of exergonic reactions that are coupled to ATP production, and that's the whole purpose of cellular respiration, and that is to produce ATP. How much ATP do you need a day?
A lot.
Like how much? Around half your body weight in ATP. Now, do you recall me saying that or not? Oh, I didn't mention this. Oh, all right. Well, I need to mention this. Okay. It'll become more apparent, but you learned way back when, maybe in a biology class sometime, what organelle is always attributed with the function of producing ATP? Yeah, mitochondria. You always learn that's the powerhouse. we're going to get into see how the mitochondria really works in this class. There is a metabolite, or there is a molecule that mitochondria need in order to make ATP, and that's oxygen. Without oxygen, mitochondria cannot make ATP. So what delivers oxygen in your body? Your blood. Yeah, your blood carries oxygen in your body every place, including your brain. So when you lose blood supply to your brain, for instance, when your heart stops, it goes into asystole or fibrillation or something, and it's not pumping blood. Blood doesn't go to your brain. How long can you maintain consciousness without oxygen being delivered to your brain, which means that oxygen is not being delivered to mitochondria, which means mitochondria cannot make ATP. That's the energy source for that fuels your consciousness. How long can you maintain consciousness without blood supply?
A
minute or 2 minutes, something like that.
64
seconds, all those are really good guesses, but the generally accepted figure is between 2 and 4 seconds. So that's what? Average 3 seconds. So you have 3 seconds of consciousness without your heart pumping. Now you might say, well, I can hold my breath for longer than 3 seconds and I don't pass out. Why is that? Because your heart is still pumping, right? And you still have a lot of oxygen in your blood that's being delivered to your brain. But if your heart stops, you got 3 seconds. All right, now, so that kind of underscores how important ATP production is to your brain, and you have a lot of other vital organs that are just as, that need ATP just as much, like your retina, your kidneys, okay, as well as your brain, and your heart needs ATP too at about the same rate. Now, you lose consciousness in 3 seconds. Without ATP, what's your brain going to do besides just lose consciousness? Yeah, it's going to die because your brain needs that energy to stay alive. Can anybody give me an example of why your brain needs ATP to stay alive? What's happening? You learned a process in here that requires ATP. What's that? I'm pumping a well. Okay, what have you learned? The sodium potassium ATP pump needs ATP. All right, so that's one of the reasons why your brain needs ATP, to keep those sodium potassium pumps working. All right, when those pumps run out of energy, how long does it take before your brain will die? If you go unconscious in 3 seconds, when are your brain actually dead?
2 to 4 minutes.
Okay, 2 to 4 minutes. That's right. So after 3 minutes, your brain actually dies. And when your brain dies, what does that mean? Yeah, it can't come back to life, right? That's an irreversible process. So that's how important ATP is, at least for the brain and a number of other vital functions, right? So cellular respiration is taking care of that job for you. Okay, so now how much ATP then do you need? This is where I kind of already asked you this question, and now you know the answer already. How much ATP does your body need per day? Yeah, it's about half your body weight. So you don't need to be carrying a luggage of ATP around with you because, why? As soon as you utilize ATP, what do mitochondria do for you? It makes more through coupling with these exergonic reactions that we're looking at. So you don't need to carry 40 kilograms of ATP around, but that's how much your body burns every day. So that's the importance of these different pathways that we're looking at. Okay. All right, so glycolysis. So here is glycolysis, and you don't have to know all of the intermediate steps right here, but you should know that how many arrows, say, between phosphoglyceric acid and 3-phosphoglycerate and 2-phosphoglycerate, right? That sounds almost like the same compound right here. It's just a phosphate has shifted positions on phosphoglycerate. How many arrows do you see with this chemical reaction right here? Is it a one-way street or two-way street? It's a two-way street. All right, so glycolysis can actually run in the reverse direction depending on the law of mass action. What's another name for law of mass action? La Chatelier's principle, right? Okay. So glycolysis can run in the reverse direction, so pyruvate can be converted back into glucose. All right, and of course it's going to take some ATP. You're going to use up ATP to get it to go back in the reverse direction. And that process is called gluconeogenesis. gluconeogenesis is glycolysis running backwards. All right, so the buildup of peruvic acid will have a tendency to make glycolysis run backwards. And in so doing, if gluconeogenesis is taking place, what about ATP production? Is that happening? Is ATP being produced? No, as a matter of fact, it's being used up. Only glycolysis produces what? These two net ATPs. Okay. All right, so this happens under, this can run under anaerobic conditions. Under aerobic conditions, pyruvic acid is going to be used up by mitochondria. All right, so in that case, pyruvic acid can't be used to go back to make glucose, which is a good thing for your body to make ATP. But under anaerobic conditions, pyruvic acid cannot even enter the mitochondria. So it's going to build up inside the cytosol. And if it builds up in the cytosol, what happens to glycolysis? It stops, right, because of Le Chatelier's principle. What else is happening? Well, NAD plus is being converted into NADH. So NADH is going to build up if pyruvic acid can't enter the mitochondria. And if NADH builds up inside the cell, what happens to glycolysis? It stops as well because it's going to force what gluconeogenesis to take place. Another way of looking at when NADH builds up, what happens to the levels of NAD plus in the cytosol? It lowers it, right? And when there is no NADH plus in the cytosol, what about glycolysis? It stops as well, right? Because it's a necessary intermediate. All right, so under anaerobic conditions, there is a nice outlet, and that's called the lactate dehydrogenase reaction. It gets rid of pyruvic acid, right? Because if pyruvic acid builds up, it's going to force glycolysis to run backwards. But also in so doing, it's going to regenerate NAD+, and it's going to get rid of NADH, right? So if there's a buildup of NADH in the cytosol, again, you could think of that as being like a poison for glycolysis that will stop glycolysis. So under anaerobic conditions, lactic acid is produced, thereby regenerating this intermediate for glycolysis, removing pyruvic acid so that glycolysis can keep going. And if glycolysis can still operate, why is that good for the cell? Because what's happening? Because it still can make ATP. Glycolysis makes, how many ATPs are produced by glycolysis? Yeah, just two. It makes four altogether, but you use up two to get glycolysis working, so it makes a net two. So that's the purpose of this lactate dehydrogenase reaction. It maintains glycolysis so that these cells can make some ATP even under anaerobic conditions. So sometimes we call this anaerobic respiration or fermentation. And in lab, you used another fermentation reaction in yeast. What was the fermentation in yeast that you guys studied? Did you do that experiment yet? Did you use the little chimney with yeast? Well, you used a sugar molecule, which ended up going to pyruvate. Ooh, nice dark marker. Pyruvate. All right, pyruvate then gets decarboxylated. How many carbons are in pyruvate or pyruvic acid? There's three. All right, and there's one decarboxylation, so what's left over? Two. And what is that two-carbon compound? This is it. These solid lines right here just represent hydrogen atoms. So that's an ethyl, all right? And there's an OH. What kind of functional group is OH? That's a hydroxyl. So this is an alcohol. This is ethyl alcohol. And what can you tell me about ethyl alcohol? Wow, nobody knows a thing about ethyl alcohol in here. Okay, I'll have to explain that to you. All right, ethyl alcohol is a compound in adult beverages, like beer, wine, hard liquor, and things like that. And what can you tell me about ethyl alcohol? It is toxic. Yeah, it makes you drunk. It's intoxicating. It's a toxic compound to especially the central nervous system. All right, so yeast produce CO2 and ethyl alcohol right here. And that's the process that's used to make bread rise, for instance. This is a process that's used to make beer and wine. And if they keep the CO2 inside the wine, it becomes champagne, for instance. Okay. So we don't have this enzyme. We don't have alcohol dehydrogenase. Why is that? Why don't people have alcohol dehydrogenase? But yeast do. Because alcohol is toxic to our nervous systems, right? Because if we had alcohol dehydrogenase, we could get intoxicated just by doing what? Just by holding our breath, right? Because then our bodies would experience an anaerobic condition. It would be without oxygen, and this enzyme would take over. Our glycolysis would be maintained because pyruvic acid would be used up. This also regenerates NAD right here, but then we would be hurting our brains by doing that. All right, so we don't have that enzyme system because we have a nervous system. What about a yeast? They don't have nervous systems, right? So it's not particularly toxic to them. They're fine with that. All right. Yeah. Yes?
But it's not
going to take on the platform. Gluconeogenesis. All right, that can take place. Yeah?
But why does pyruvic acid decide to stay on the platform?
Only because of anaerobic conditions. If oxygen is present, pyruvic acid will enter the mitochondria. And it will be metabolized further. For what purpose? To make even more ATP, okay? Because that's the job of the mitochondria, to make a lot of ATP. But the mitochondria can only do their job when there is oxygen present. If oxygen is not present, then pyruvic acid can't even go inside the mitochondria. It's trapped outside, okay? All right, so that takes us to, to some more slides. All right. For osmotic reasons, cells can't store many free glucoses, right? Because of osmotic pressure. Your cells like to store glucose for cellular respiration, but it can't store millions and millions of molecules of glucose because what's going to happen to water if all of a sudden a cell started to store millions of molecules of glucose? What would happen to water? It's going to rush inside the cell, burst the cell. Can't have that happen. So your cells put glucoses together to form a big polysaccharide of glucose. So now it's only one molecule. It doesn't have the same osmotic properties. Water doesn't rush inside the cell. The cell remains its shape. All right, so what do we call that process when glucose is converted to the big polymer? And that big polymer we call glycogen. Okay, we call that glycogenesis. Glyco, standing for glycogen. Genesis is the making of glycogen. And what kind of chemical reaction is used for that? That's called a dehydration synthesis reaction, right? That's kind of, you should be kind of familiar with that already. All right, so skeletal muscle and liver store lots of glycogen. Okay, now how do these cells get glucose out of glycogen? It's through the reverse reaction. What's the reverse reaction called? Yeah, hydrolysis reaction. But in terms of glycogen, now we call that glycogenolysis. Now that should be kind of familiar with you because you learned another term that's sort of familiar, which is what? Glycolysis. Glycolysis is the breaking up of glucose. Glycogenolysis is the breaking up of glycogen. Right. Okay, so there are now four terms. Ooh, that was a nice marker. Where did I put it? Okay, there are four terms. We've got what? Glycolysis, right? Gluconeogenesis, all right? Glycogenesis. All right, and glycogenolysis. All right, so here are four terms. Glycolysis, what's the reverse of glycolysis? Gluconeogenesis. right? Glucose then can be used to make glycogen, that's glycogenesis. And what's the opposite of glycogenesis? Glycogenolysis. Okay. So here are four terms that you got to understand the definition of, and maybe you can't use them with facility very quickly, right? You might have to think about which way the pathways are working, right? That's time on the, that's okay on the test to take your time. But you should also know the spelling of these four terms and which direction these metabolic pathways go. Okay? So these four metabolic pathways are pretty much involved with what important metabolite in your body?
Glucose,
right? Maintaining blood levels of glucose. And do you know any pathologies where there is abnormal maintenance or homeostasis of blood glucose?
Diabetes.
Yeah, diabetes mellitus in particular, right? So if you're going to be interested in treating patients with diabetes, you want to be familiar with all of these pathways, not just insulin, not just the uptake of glucose. Because, all right, and we'll study diabetes some more in this class. One way that you know to handle diabetes, which means that you have an elevated blood glucose, that could be one of the conditions, elevated blood glucose. One way to deal with that is to give somebody insulin, which then allows glucose to leave the blood and enter cells, thereby lowering blood glucose. But that is only glucose, maybe, that you have in your diet. How else could you help somebody with diabetes mellitus? Maybe you could inhibit gluconeogenesis, right? The production of having somebody's own body make glucose. Or maybe you could inhibit glycogenolysis, which again is going to elevate blood glucose. Right, so there are a number of different pathways, and these are how all the other different kinds of pharmaceuticals are used, not just for replacements of insulin. Right, so we have to be familiar with these different kinds of pathways. Okay. All right, so two organs, important organs that can store glucose in the form of glycogen, they are muscle and liver. All right, glycogenolysis clips the glucose off of the glycogen as glucose 6-phosphate. Right, that phosphate then traps these molecules inside the cell. Because what can you tell me about this phosphate right here? What does it really look like? Right, it's highly polar. Right, it's and so since it's a highly polar functional group, it can't go through the cell membrane. Right, so muscle cells don't have an ability to take that phosphate off of glucose. Muscle cells, once glucose gets in, it's always phosphorylated and it's trapped inside the cell as glucose 6-phosphate. So a muscle cell is really greedy. It will only donate that phosphate to glycolysis for its own ATP production. The liver, on the other hand, has an enzyme that can take this phosphate group off, and then as a result, it can secrete glucose into the blood. So the liver has the ability to secrete glucose into the blood to maintain blood glucose levels when you're in a fasted state. Now, does anybody remember what the name of an enzyme is that can take a phosphate group off of something? Phosphatase, right? So that phosphatase, the liver phosphatase, glucose 6-phosphatase, is an important enzyme for maintaining your blood glucose when you're in a fasted state. But muscles don't have that enzyme. All right, so make sure you're familiar with glycolysis, glycogenesis, glycogenolysis, and gluconeogenesis. Try to maybe have a picture in your mind is the best way to remember that. All right, what about lipogenesis? What does that mean? You should at least know what that term means. Lipogenesis is the making of more lipid, right? Lipolysis is the breaking down of lipid, and again, that's going to be coupled to ATP production. Ketogenesis, I'll see if I can talk about this sometime in the class, but that is just what the producing of ketone bodies, and that's a side reaction that happens with diabetics or people that are starving themselves from sugar. I don't know if I'll have a chance to talk about that this semester or not. Okay, so here are some pathways which you should be able to recognize as being glycogenesis or glycogenolysis or glycolysis or gluconeogenesis. So for instance, here is glucose that's in the blood. And it's going to be taken up by many tissues, muscle and liver. And when it gets in those tissues, what do the tissues do? It phosphorylates it. What kind of enzyme phosphorylates glucose and turns it into glucose 6-phosphate? What's an enzyme that phosphorylates something? One that dephosphorylates is a phosphatase. The one that phosphorylates, remember, is a kinase. It's a kinase. So here is a glucose kinase, and it puts a phosphate on the number six carbon of that glucose molecule. Now, what can you tell me about this glucose 6-phosphate right here? Can it go through the plasma membrane? No, it's trapped because it is really a hydrophilic molecule. Can't get through the plasma membrane. So now it's inside the cell. It's got three possible fates. It can be used to generate ATP via glycolysis, right? So glucose 6-phosphate is going to end up as 2-pyruvate, for instance. Right? Glucose 6-phosphate, for instance, if the cell is energy rich in ATP, then the cell is going to store that glucose. It won't give it to glycolysis right away. It will store it in the form of glycogen via what kind of metabolic pathway? That is called glycogenesis. Glycogenesis is going to make glycogen. All right, but if ATP in this cell is running low, or maybe some other cells, maybe blood glucose is decreasing, right? Glycogen can be broken down back into glucose 6-phosphate, right? And this pathway is called glycogenolysis, right? Glycogenolysis, and you could probably tell me this is what a glycogen phosphatase that's going to, or kinase is going to make glucose 1-phosphate right here. All right, and in skeletal muscle, then skeletal muscles will never release this back into the blood. They'll use it for glycolysis to make ATP when those muscle cells need ATP. But if this is a liver, right, and blood glucose is decreasing, then the liver can actually secrete this glucose 6-phosphate as glucose into the blood because they have the, what kind of enzyme can convert glucose 6-phosphate into pure old glucose? Yeah, glucose 6-phosphatase. It has the phosphatase enzyme. So the liver can help maintain blood glucose levels. All right, so those four metabolic pathways you should see embedded in this chart. I don't think I have this as an exam figure. All right, but I think I have this one as an exam figure, which basically says the same thing. This is the Cori cycle, and let's just say that we're going to compare metabolism between a liver cell and a muscle cell. And let's start right up over here. All right, so we have blood glucose. Glucose is taken up by skeletal muscle, and if the muscle is exercising, it needs ATP, right? So that glucose is going to be donated to glycolysis. It's going to produce ATP, going to have this pyruvic acid. The other thing that we see right here is what the lactate dehydrogenase pathway. If this muscle is exercising strenuously or severely, right, for instance, like this biceps brachii right here, when it contracts, what happens to it? It changes form amazingly from what kind of a fluid tissue to what? An incredibly solid chunk of muscle. It's so solid that blood can't even get into it. Right? So what happens if blood can't get into this muscle right here? And I don't want to do this for too long. All right, because it's running low on oxygen, all right, and it's becoming anaerobic, and under anaerobic conditions, pyruvic acid, oh, that felt good to relax my arm, okay, because that pyruvic acid is converted into lactic acid to maintain glycolysis. Okay, so now here you have a metabolite that still has a lot of energy left in it. It can leave the cell, it goes into the blood, right, it's taken up by the liver. The liver doesn't contract. As long as the heart is beating, it's always going to have oxygen. And under aerobic conditions, lactic acid gets converted to pyruvic acid, right? And then what can a liver do with pyruvic acid? It can make glucose out of it again via what kind of pathway? Gluconeogenesis, right? Gluconeogenesis. And then the liver has glucose 6-phosphatase, and it can then secrete that glucose into the blood, and it can be taken up by the muscle again, and the muscle then can then use glycolysis to make some ATP. All right, so this is a nice cyclic reaction that's shared between two different organ systems, but that just means that the liver has to be healthy and the liver has to have oxygen in order for this to take place. So muscles can defer the metabolic burden of dealing with lactic acid to the liver, but what does the liver need? The liver needs oxygen in order for this to take place. All right, so what else can happen inside this muscle right here? Well, if the muscle is not exercising, glucose-6-phosphate gets converted to glycogen. What's that metabolic pathway called? Glycogenesis. All right, so number 9 right here is glycogenesis. And then if the muscle starts to exercise again, this glucose and glycogen can be released for cellular respiration. What's this process called? Going from glycogen to glucose, that is glycogenolysis. Got to probably write it out a number of times. All right. okay. And then over here we see gluconeogenesis taking place in this liver cell. All right. So if you don't think you can see the difference between glycolysis, gluconeogenesis, glycogenesis, and glycogenolysis, then you got to get your vision checked before the test. Right, you got to be able to see that those terms are spelled differently because, I mean, they're much different in the cell and how they protect your life. Yeah.
So the purpose of glycogenesis is when the muscles already have a lot of glucose in it and it stores it into glycogen.
And it can't store it as glucose. Why can't a muscle cell store?
Osmotic reasons.
Yeah, because of osmotic reasons, the water would rush into the cell and blow the cell up. So it gets all stuck together into one molecule, and we don't have that problem. Yeah.
When the lactic acid from the cell comes up to the liver.
Right here?
Yeah, and then when the liver secretes it back out as glucose,
yeah.
Can it also secrete it to other cells besides muscle?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So it just helps maintain blood glucose. Yeah. Okay. So that's the Cori cycle. Okay, so that's a little bit of what happens under anaerobic conditions. All right, let's go to aerobic conditions. All right, under aerobic I tell you what, let's go all the way back to that first slide right here. Here's the first slide. All right, so blood enters the cell, so here this lightly shaded area right here kind of looks like institutional tan to me. Is that like a tan color or what is that? Who knows?
Yellow.
Okay. This is just what? The cytosol, because glycolysis happens in the cytosol just because there are enzymes dissolved in the cytosol that enhance, that speed up the rate of these reactions. Now, under aerobic conditions, guess what happens to pyruvic acid? It enters mitochondria, okay? So there are three reactions here that are very important. The first one is a preparatory reaction, and if I forgot, I want you to pencil that in on your notes, right? So here, the first reaction for making ATP is glycolysis. The second one is this preparatory reaction that's going to take pyruvic acid and donate it to the Krebs cycle. The third one is the Krebs cycle itself. And the fourth reaction is electron transport. So the three reactions in the mitochondria are preparatory, Krebs, and electron transport. So now we want to look at these reactions in a little bit more detail. And where are these taking place? Close, but it's an organelle. Try it again. Where are the preparatory reactions, Krebs and electron transport, taking place? In the mitochondria. And under what kind of conditions? Under aerobic conditions, because, well, you don't see oxygen coming in here, but we'll take a look and see where it comes in. All right, so everything in the mitochondria needs oxygen to take place. All right, so here is the preparatory reaction. Pyruvic acid enters, and it is bound to coenzyme A. What's the job of a coenzyme again?
Transport.
Yeah, it's to transport molecules or maybe high-energy electrons from one set of reactions to another. And a coenzyme is a large organic molecule. I probably won't ever show you a picture of what coenzyme A looks like, right? Because it's a very large organic molecule. But it has what? This sulfhydryl functional group right here is very reactive. And so pyruvic acid, oh, what's this functional group right here? C CO2H. That's a carboxyl group, all right? And that allows for a relatively easy decarboxylation reaction to take place. But it is also an oxidation reduction reaction. So along with pyruvic acid and coenzyme A, we need, well, we need some other participants to undergo an oxidation reduction reaction, namely NAD+. So pyruvic acid plus coenzyme A plus NAD+ goes to NADH. And what is about, what is NADH doing for us? Okay. Yeah, but it's carrying something too. It's carrying electrons. So you can say hydrogens. I prefer to actually think of electrons, high energy electrons. So you could think of NAD or NADH as being what? A coenzyme. Right? It's a coenzyme because it's carrying something, high energy electrons. And we end up with acetyl coenzyme A. And so we have coenzyme A bound to this two carbon group right here, this two carbon fragment. This is an acetyl group. All right, and what happened to the third carbon in pyruvic acid? It's gone because it is now turned into CO2. And what does your body do with CO2? Yeah, we don't blow up like a loaf of bread. Okay, we breathe that out of our body. All right, so CO2 is a byproduct of respiration, and we excrete it from our body when we exhale. Yeah.
So the bottom line here is the preparatory step is the conversion of acetyl-coenzyme A from pyruvic acid. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Okay. But in so doing, we get some high-energy intermediates that we're not going to waste. And that high-energy intermediate is NADH. All right. So for every glucose, this preparatory reaction makes how many NADHs for every glucose? Okay, it makes two. Because from every glucose, how many pyruvic acids do you make?
Two.
You make two because you chop a glucose in half, right? So you make two NADHs by the preparatory reaction. I don't see ATP being made right here, but that's okay because guess what the mitochondria are going to do? They're going to take NADH and use that to make ATP. All right, and we're going to talk about that in just a second. The other one is released, but in so doing, though, some of that energy in this bond right here is trapped in NADH in the form of high-energy electrons. High-energy electrons. And you can imagine where those high-energy electrons go. That's the fourth reaction. What was the fourth reaction? Electron transport chain. Okay?
So NADH is a reduced version of NAD.
That's right. Because it's carrying high energy electrons. All right, it's produced by an oxidation reduction reaction. All right, so acetyl CoA then can donate the acetyl group to the Krebs cycle. All right, so here is a precursor molecule that's going to accept the acetyl group. It's called oxaloacetic acid, you know, and I don't really care that you know the names of these things, but this is a four carbon fragment, and when we add a two-carbon fragment to it, what do we end up with? A six. We call that citric acid, and then these intermediates are going to be interconverted, and this is also a set of exothermic reactions that are going to release energy, and what can you do with the release of that energy? Yeah, you can make some ATP out of it, all right? And some of it is going to be in the form of NADH, some of it is going to be in the form of FADH2, and the other form is going to be a GTP, guanosine triphosphate. All right. So if you start with a four-carbon unit and you make one turn of the Krebs cycle and you end up with a four-carbon unit, all right, even though you donated a two-carbon unit to it, what does that mean? What's being produced? Two more carbon dioxides. All right. So another good kind of question to ask on an exam is, what organelle produces carbon dioxide via cellular respiration? You're going to say the mitochondria. One reaction is the, right, because here's the mitochondria, right? Pyruvic acid entered the mitochondria right here. All right, so that's that organelle that's producing CO2 that we have to breathe out of our bodies. One CO2 is produced by the preparatory reaction, the other two CO2 by the Krebs cycle. Okay, let's look in a little bit more detail. But the next detail figure is not an exam figure. Okay. This one right here. This is not an exam figure, but this shows us some detail. And you have to look at this to understand enough detail, again, to answer some of those questions, like where does CO2 come from? The previous slide tells us what the net result of one turn of the Krebs cycle is. What does one turn of the Krebs cycle produce? Well, okay, it produces, that's not on this slide right here, it produces one, where's the other one? Two CO2, where's it? Here, one, thank you, one, two, it produces two CO2, all right, but those are just waste products, so that's not included in the previous slide. One turn produces one GTP. The free energy of guanosine triphosphate is equal to the free energy in ATP, so what does that mean? That GTP and ATP can be interconverted very easily. So when you make a GTP, that's like making an ATP, right? You don't have to worry about any kind of reaction there. It's very easy to do, all right? One turn of the Krebs cycle produces three NADHs and one FADH2. All right, and don't forget, the NADH and FADH2 carry something. They're coenzymes. What are they carrying? They're carrying, I would like for you to think, your book says hydrogen, I would like for you to say high energy electrons. All right? Okay. So let's take a look at this one turn of the Krebs cycle. All right, acetyl-CoA comes in, forms citric acid. All right, through a bunch of different rearrangements and oxidation-reduction reactions, like when isocitrate gets converted to alpha-ketoglutarate, right? That's a decarboxylation step, but that is also coupled to a oxidation-reduction reaction. So NAD inside the mitochondria is converted into, or is reduced to, NADH. And NADH is good because it's carrying high-energy electrons. Your mitochondria can make ATP from that. So there is one. Here's another step as a result of another decarboxylation. Right, another NADH is made. In this fifth step over here, guanosine diphosphate is phosphorylated to GTP, and then that can be used right away to phosphorylate ADP to make an ATP. So with one turn, you get an ATP. The next step is an oxidation-reduction reaction, and that produces FADH2. Now, what is FADH2 carrying? Yep, two electrons, just like NADH. All right, but these electrons are lower in energy. Okay, they're lower in energy. And then one of the last steps, you see another NADH being made. So here, with one turn of the Krebs cycle, you get three NADHs, one ATP, and one FADH2. All right, so that's making some ATP for you. Now, under what kind of conditions does this take place? Only under aerobic conditions. What organelles is taking place in? Mitochondria. Right, okay. All right, so don't forget, three NADHs, one FADH2, and one ATP. All right, so where do those high energy electrons go? You can refer to that very first slide. They are donated to the electron transport chain. And don't forget, when a molecule accepts an electron, it becomes reduced. All right, and so the molecule that is donating those electrons to the molecule that's being reduced, what happens to it? It becomes
oxidized.
So oxidation-reduction reactions are always coupled to each other. And these electrons will flow from a state of high free energy to a state of low free energy. So as those electrons move through these various chemicals right here, are they gaining energy or releasing energy? They're releasing energy. And what kind of reaction releases energy? Okay, an exergonic reaction, right? It's the reverse of this one. And what do mitochondria know how to do? They know how to couple this exergonic metabolic pathway to ATP production, which is an endergonic reaction. Okay, so let's kind of pay attention to see how that might happen. All right, so NADH donates some electrons to a chemical compound we call FMN. It becomes reduced, it becomes FMNH2, there are some high energy electrons then which can be donated to coenzyme Q, which then can donate them to cytochrome B, right? So these electrons just basically flow from one molecule to another through a series of oxidation reduction reactions. So this electron transport chain, you should actually think of almost as a wire that's carrying electrons within a mitochondria. And as these electrons flow through these various compounds, look what can happen. That energy is released, and it can be used for the phosphorylation of ADP and making ATP. All right. So for every NADH that donates two electrons to electron transport, and this is what I would like for you to memorize, how many ATPs can be made as these electrons flow through all these coenzymes and cytochromes in the electron transport chain? You see? One, two, three. All right. What is the molecule that accepts all of these electrons?
Oxygen
right here. All right. So if oxygen is not present, none of these electrons can flow through the electron transport chain. The presence of oxygen acts like a switch that turns us on the electron transport chain on and off. So the presence of oxygen in mitochondria is like that, exactly analogous to that switch on the wall, turning electron transport on and off. All right, so that's why oxygen is necessary. All right, so oxygen, does it become oxidized or reduced? It's reduced, right? It becomes reduced, and it also then gets some of these protons that are in the matrix of the mitochondria, and that forms water. Okay, so that's where that term oxidation comes from, because what's a molecule is very important is oxygen, because it can become easily reduced. Okay, which then does what? It oxidizes some other molecule. Right, because oxidation-reduction reactions always take place. So the last molecule that is formed by electron transport is this one right here, which is water. And that's pretty fascinating, because you've seen water is an important metabolite. It participates in many chemical reactions. Well, what else is it in our body? It's the solvent molecule. Right? It's just kind of amazing that the solvent molecule is actually an active participant in many important chemical reactions in our body. All right, the other thing that you see on this chart right here is if NADH can produce three ATPs because it has high energy electrons, right, what about FADH2? These are lower in energy. These electrons are lower in energy. They aren't donated to FMN. They're donated to coenzyme Q. How many ATPs can be produced by these electrons from FADH2? Only two. All right, so your book goes into a lot of discussion about the number of ATPs that can be produced by NADH. Sometimes it's 2.5. Under some conditions, it might be 2.54. Under other conditions, it might be 2.7. All right, the theoretical maximum is what? 1, 2, 3. And that's what I want you to know. All right? So you don't have to know all of these complicating factors. All right, so just say for every NADH, now where do these NADH have to be? In the cytosol or in the mitochondria? In the mitochondria, right, can make 3 ATP. What about for FADH2? Your book says under real world circumstances, it might be 1.5, might be 1.6, might be 1.7. But what will we say in here?
Two.
All right, but realizing that's a theoretical maximum, and in other tissues, under other kinds of circumstances, it might not reach that theoretical maximum. All right, but from here on out, all of our calculations, we'll just say 3 for NADH, 2 for FADH2. Yeah?
So the electron
transport
chain produces water. So
yes?
It happens on the mitochondria, so the mitochondria releases water?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Just one molecule for these two electrons. Yep, and these two protons that enter. Okay. All right, so now, how does the mitochondria couple this exogonic reaction with these three endergonic reactions? Right, because the mitochondria is a fairly, I guess I need to say something about this slide. But the mitochondria is kind of a complex organelle. Who could tell me something about the structure of a mitochondria?
Sorry.
Yeah, it's got a series of membranes. It's got an outer membrane, it's got an inner membrane, so it's got an inner membrane space, and then it even has a space inside the inner membrane. We call that the matrix. Don't be confused with connective tissue there. That's just the matrix. Okay, well, I think I did talk about that already. Okay, before I show you the next slide, I do want to say something about ATP production. When it's made via the electron transport chain in the presence of oxygen, we call that oxidative phosphorylation. Oxidative phosphorylation couples the flow of electrons through ETC into the endergonic reaction of ATP synthesis. That is oxidative phosphorylation. Now, in cellular respiration, we saw ATP made by other kinds of processes besides the electron transport chain. Where did we see that? We saw it here in the Krebs cycle. And somebody said, well, we saw that in glycolysis. Right? We did see that in glycolysis. How far do I have to go back? Right here. All right, so here is ATP that's being synthesized. And again, there's no flow of electrons right here. This is just due to an enzymatic reaction. The production of ATP made by glycolysis and the Krebs cycle is what we call substrate level phosphorylation. All right, so substrate level phosphorylation as opposed to, what's the other kind? Oxidative phosphorylation. So these are both phosphorylation processes that take place. All right, so oxidative phosphorylation is something very special, and we're going to see why that's special right now. I went too far. What happened to... here it is. Okay. So how is this electron transport, which is exergonic, how is it coupled to ATP synthesis? Okay. That process is called oxidative phosphorylation. And here is the model that you should have in your mind. Anybody need the sign-in sheet? No? Okay. Yeah. Pass it one row and they'll pass it over that way. Down over there. All right, so here we have a nice zoomed-in region of a mitochondria, and we know this is mitochondria because here is the outer membrane. Can you recognize that as a membrane? Yeah, because the phospholipid bilayer, it doesn't look like it has many kinds of proteins dissolved in it, but it does. Here is another membrane, and in the inner membrane, right, which is what we call the Christi membrane, it has the proteins and coenzymes of the electron transport chain dissolved in it. So remember that the membrane is you should think of it as a fluid mosaic, right? It's very fluid. It has a lot of proteins dissolved in it. And so NADH inside the matrix of the mitochondria, this is where the Krebs cycle takes place, producing all of those NADHs. NADH then can donate those high energy electrons to this protein, for instance, like FMN. And as those electrons flow through this protein that's in the membrane, it's going to release energy. That energy can be used to actually pump hydrogen ions from the matrix to this intermembrane space right here. So when I say pump, what does that mean? What does a pump do? What kind of transport process is a pump? Okay, facilitated diffusion, key word there is diffusion. Diffusion goes from high concentration to low. When we look at the concentration of protons between the matrix and the inner membrane space, it is low, okay, the protons are low in the matrix but high in the intermembrane space. So how does something go from low to high? It's got to be active transport. It means it needs an energy source. And that and usually it's coupled to ATP, but in this particular case, in the Christi membrane, the energy source is coming from these electrons as they flow from one molecule to to another, to another, to another, right? So these couple oxidation reduction reactions are releasing energy that is used to pump protons from the matrix into the intermembrane space. So now you have, all right, a high concentration of protons in the intermembrane space and low in the matrix. Which way do those protons want to go? They want to go back down into the matrix, right? So there is what? There is energy in that proton gradient, right? There is energy in any kind of gradient. What do we call a gradient of electrical charge? When there's a separation of charge from one spot to another. One spot is negative and another is positive. That's polarity. Well, that's what we call a battery, right? And when a battery is charged up, it has energy, and that just has the ability to do some kind of work, right? All right, so here is a gradient in protons, low in the matrix, high in the intermembrane space. But look at these electrons. They don't flow through just one pump. They flow through one, two, three different pumps. All right, what about FADH2? It donates it maybe at about this level right here instead of at this level here. So it can only pump a fewer number of protons into the intermembrane space. All right, so this is the electron transport chain that is sort of quasi-labeled. You can see ubiquinone and cytochrome C, but don't forget there's other compounds in there. I don't think I would ask you, unless there's a question in the web, on the name of any of the electron transport molecules. Right? But these are just carrying electrons, and as these electrons flow, they lose energy. That energy, because remember, energy can neither be created nor destroyed, so that energy can be used to move protons into this intermembrane space. And here is oxygen that is the final acceptor of these electrons from the electron transport chain that produces water. Now, the last protein that is embedded in the Christi membrane is ATP synthetase, or ATP synthase, and it's a channel. It's a channel for protons. Because can a proton move across this membrane right here all by itself? And you say no. And I like that. Why can't it get through here?
Because it's going from low to high concentration.
Nope. It's not because of concentration gradient. Because this proton is what kind of molecule? Hydrophilic or hydrophobic?
Hydrophilic.
It's hydrophilic. It can't get through this big hydrophobic region of the Christi membrane. So it's stuck right here. So does this proton want to move back into the matrix? Because it's high in the intermembrane space, low in the matrix, sure, it's dying to get back, right? It wants to flow down the concentration gradient, but it can't get through the membrane because it has the wrong kind of polarity associated with it. But here is a way that it can do that, right, through the ATP synthase. And as it flows from high concentration to low, right, this special protein right here can use that energy, right, because there is energy in the gradient, it can use that energy to phosphorylate ADP. ATP synthase in the Christi membrane can take ADP, inorganic phosphate, using the flow of protons, can phosphorylate ADP to make ATP. So this is why we call this oxidative phosphorylation. All right, so can you see that there is a form of energy in the proton gradient between the intermembrane space and the matrix? And that energy can be used by this molecule right here to make ATP. So that's how this exergonic reaction of electron transport can be coupled to an endergonic reaction right here, just because of the unique structure and proteins of the mitochondria. But in order for mitochondria to do this, what molecule do they need? They need oxygen to make sure those electrons flow through ETC. If they don't flow through ETC, then the mitochondria can't make ATP. As a matter of fact, they will do something worse if we have time to talk about that. Okay, so ATP can be made by two different ways. Direct, which I call substrate level phosphorylation, which happens where? Glycolysis, right? And also the Krebs cycle. Oxidative phosphorylation happens where? In the electron transport chain. So let's see I don't like a number of these slides right here, so I want to put some of these things on the board. Let's just do a little synopsis of cellular respiration on the board. All right, so I might need some help with this. So let's tally up and maybe look at just one little deviation on how many ATP can be produced. And let's see, maybe I'll get a couple of different markers right here. What about for glycolysis? Okay, glycolysis can make two what? Yeah, it can make two ATP for what? Every? Yeah, for every glucose molecule. And there are two conditions that you should think of, anaerobic conditions and aerobic conditions. Under aerobic conditions, what else does glycolysis produce? A high energy intermediate. It can also produce two NADH as a result.
Under aerobic
conditions. Under anaerobic conditions, it can't. All right, but under aerobic conditions, 2-NADH. All right, then what about the prep reaction? What happens here?
Acetyl coenzyme A.
Yeah, that produces CO2. But I'm only interested in energy for our bodies. What else does it make? For every glucose. Remember, when it decarboxylates, it's also oxidation reduction reaction, so it's going to produce, all right, 2-NADH as a result of that, 2-NADHs. All right, so from going from pyruvate in the cytosol to the preparatory reaction, what's happening there? It's got to enter the mitochondria. So put a little line or something there so you realize that enters the mitochondria. That means that's under aerobic conditions. All right, then the Krebs cycle. What happens in Krebs? It can make three. Yeah, okay, ATP. How many ATP? Okay, one ATP. Oh, that's for one turn, but it's two turns for every glucose. Okay, so it can make 2 ATP for every glucose. All right, and I was going to write 3 NADH, but that's for one turn of the Krebs cycle. How many times does it turn around for every glucose? Twice. So that really should be a 6. All right, so 6 NADH, and that's it, right? Ah, you reminded me. 2 what? DH2s. 2-FADH2s. Okay, that's the Krebs cycle. All right, so now, so the cell has 2 ATP from glycolysis. That's good. But in order to make ATP from these NADHs in the cytosol, where does NADH have to go? It's got to actually go into the mitochondria. That's not an easy task. Right? It has to be converted into something, and the only way it can get in is if it's converted into FADH2. So it loses some energy. Right? So the 2 NADHs in the cytosol get converted into 2 FADH2s. So how many ATP then does it take to get an NADH into the mitochondria? How many are you using? According to the theoretical maximum. This is worth 3 ATPs if it were in the mitochondria. Okay. It can't do it. It's got to be converted into FADH2. How many ATPs is FADH2?
2.
So it takes an ATP. It takes an ATP's worth of energy to get NADH from the cytosol into the mitochondria. So it does lose some energy to do that. All right, so now let's look at ATP by what? Oxidative phosphorylation. ATP by oxidative phosphorylation, and let's think of aerobic conditions. All right, so how many ATP for this FADH2?
Two.
Yeah, let's just simplify it and say two. How many, I tell you what, how, we want to do what? Two times two. That's four ATP. What about for this NADH here by the prep reaction? It's two times three. That's six. Right? And this is what? Six times three. Uh-oh. What's that? That's 18. Okay. And these two FADH2s is what? Two times two. That's equal to four. All right, so how many ATP via these by oxidative phosphorylation? We've got 10, we've got 28, 30, 32. Okay, that's 32, but we didn't count these ATPs in there yet. All right, so 32 ATPs, then plus substrate phosphorylation, we got what? Four more. So a nice theoretical maximum would be about what? Oops. 36 ATP for the complete combustion of what? One glucose into CO2 and water. Okay, so 30-something ATP under different circumstances, other kinds of tissues and experiences. This could range anywhere from 30 to 38. ATP for every glucose. And we're not going to get into the conditions and why that might happen. All right, so, but let's compare and contrast. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Why did you multiply 2 NADH times 3 to get 6? I got lost.
Okay, so for every NADH, how many ATP can you make in electron transport? 3. Theoretical maximum is 3. All right, the Krebs cycle makes 6, so it's 6 times 3 is 18 ATP. Okay, FADH2 donates the electrons lower down in ETC, can't make as many ATPs, it can only make 2. So it's 2 FADs times 2, that's 4. All right, so, and then this NADH in the cytosol doesn't enter the mitochondria as NADH. It has to flow down a gradient, okay, and that actually has to flow up a gradient, so that costs some ATP, namely an ATP to get every NADH inside the matrix. All right, so do you see the difference between substrate level phosphorylation and oxidative phosphorylation, where they take place? All right, and why the job of the mitochondria is to make a lot of ATP, because it's set up for oxidative phosphorylation. It can trap the energy in that flow of electrons as it goes from a high free energy to a low free energy state. That's the job of mitochondria. So which process is more efficient? Yeah, oxidative phosphorylation. Okay, so if we can contrast it, under anaerobic conditions, it can only make 2 ATP. All right, and you don't even get energy from this NADH because it's got to be used to regenerate NAD to keep glycolysis working via the lactate dehydrogenase pathway. All right, but under aerobic conditions, it's in the 30s, right? So if you're going to compare them in some nice general form, anaerobic produces 2 ATP, and aerobic is what? 30-something. ATP. 2 versus 30-something. If you want to say 36, that's fine with me, or 34. So on the answer to the test, it's going to be 30-something, right? I mean, I might have 32, that's the answer, because 32 is what? It's 30-something. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So that's what you should know. So, okay, so I don't like this chart right here in your book because it goes into a little bit too much detail, because now you, instead of multiplying by 2, you're multiplying by 1.5 or 2.5 instead of 3. All right, that's just, that's more realistic, but for this class, it's not necessary. Okay. Well, do you want to learn something about this? I hope you could follow that discussion. Okay, just remember that when you go, things can happen passively if molecules move which way? From down a gradient, from high concentration to low. That automatically happens. But to go from low to high, right, that requires energy. But don't forget, you can't create or destroy energy. It can only be converted from one form to another. So if a molecule goes from high energy to low energy, that energy, biology has learned how to harness that energy, right, via the chemiosmotic hypothesis. The chemiosmotic hypothesis describes how this proton gradient can be used via ATP synthase to phosphorylate ADP to make ATP. Okay. Well, what can you tell me about mitochondria? It's an interesting organelle because not only does it make a lot of ATP, what else? Why else is it so much different than any other organelle inside your cell? It has its own DNA. And if you look at its shape, it actually looks like a bacteria. And maybe in anatomy you learned about the endosymbiont theory of mitochondria and how eukaryotic cells have developed. Right? All of our cells are really a symbiosis between a cell that had an organelle and organs and a bacteria, which was very much like this mitochondria. They learned to coexist. So what is a symbiosis again? A symbiosis is when two organisms do what? When they live together and they're both beneficial to each other. Okay? So what do our cells get from this ancient kind of bacteria that we call a mitochondria? What do we get from mitochondria? Yeah, ATP. Is that a good deal?
Yeah.
Hell of a good deal. Okay? Now what does a mitochondria get from us? They got to get something from us too. They get protection, right, because they're not predated with other kinds of bacteria or viruses, and they get also glucose or intermediates as well as oxygen. All right, so it's a happy symbiosis. Under what kind of conditions? Aerobic conditions. All right, and we've kind of learned this commonly anyway recently. Under anaerobic conditions, what happens to mitochondria? What do they do for us? All right. Or does the symbiosis break down? Well, mitochondria love to have a high hydrogen ion concentration in the intermembrane space. They love to have a low concentration in the matrix. Okay? So when oxygen is depleted, the only way that they can pump hydrogens into the intermembrane space, since the electron transport is not working, right? Under anaerobic conditions, the electron transport is not working. So these hydrogen pumps aren't working, but the mitochondria says, oh, there's a way I can still maintain my high hydrogen ion concentration in the intermembrane space, and how is that? It takes ATP synthase and runs it in the reverse direction. So the ATP synthase, instead of making ATP by letting protons flow down the gradient, the mitochondria then takes protons and pumps it up into the intermembrane space. But in so doing, what does it use up? It uses up ATP. So under anaerobic conditions, the mitochondria are actually what? Pretty harmful to our cells because they consume ATP to maintain this proton gradient. So that partly describes why you only have how many seconds of consciousness under anaerobic conditions? 3 seconds, because what do the mitochondria do? Instead of make ATP, they actually use up ATP. And I mentioned that to you because sometime, I'm sure, in our futures, we're going to find out pharmaceuticals that can turn these ATP synthases off to prevent them from running in the reverse direction, right? And what's that going to do to our tissues? That's going to, it's going to protect our tissues for a longer period of anaerobic conditions. And maybe actually our tissues maybe know how to do that because there are certain circumstances or certain people that can experience long periods of anaerobic condition. Do we know anybody? Do you know anybody? Or what kind of human can experience long periods of anaerobic conditions without injury to their brain? You might say football players. Okay, that's not true. It's what? Neonates. Right? People that are being born. Maybe somebody has an umbilical cord wrapped around their neck and we can't get it untied for minutes. All right? And they never experience brain damage, and it's we really don't know why that is, but here is maybe some mechanism that you could think of to maybe this synthase right here is okay somehow turned off, or something happens in the brains of neonates that we lose as we grow older, right? The adult brain can't tolerate those conditions of anaerobic conditions for very long at all, but a neonate sure can. So if we learn how to mimic that procedure or that protective device in an adult, I'm sure that's going to be really useful, not just for brain, but for heart or many other kinds of organs as well. Okay. All right, I do want to mention a little bit about fat metabolism. Okay, so fats can be hydrolyzed, right? They can be broken down. What's the building block of a triglyceride again? That's a glycerol and fatty acid. So that can be broken down, or a triglyceride can be broken down via hydrolysis to glycerol and fatty acids. All right, and fatty acids are just a long hydrocarbon chain. They can then be broken down, and those hydrocarbons can be put through the Krebs cycle, just like pyruvic acid or an acetyl group. Some proteins can be broken down into amino acids, that's the building block, and there are hydrocarbon chains, and those can be run through the Krebs cycle for the purpose of what? Of energy, producing ATP, right? That's what Krebs cycle does. And some of these pathways can even be used to interconvert various kinds of compounds like carbohydrates, fats, and proteins. All right, but this is actually an important slide that I want you to know something about. So here we have a fat. It can be broken down to glycerol and fatty acids. And glycerol can be converted to an intermediate of glycolysis. And once it's in glycolysis, what are the two possible fates for glycerol? It can be used to make glucose. What's that process called? What's the process when glycerol can be used to make glucose? That is gluconeogenesis. Don't forget the neo, the new making of glucose, the new making of glucose. Or it can be used to complete glycolysis, so those carbons enter the Krebs cycle and produce ATP for us. All right, but fatty acids are, and don't forget these are two arrows right here, fatty acids, on the other hand, can only enter the Krebs cycle as a two-carbon fragment, not a three-carbon fragment. All right, so that means it enters the Krebs cycle as an acetyl group. Now, what about the conversion from acetyl-CoA to pyruvic acid? How many arrows do you see?
Only one.
Yeah, it's a one-way street, right? So any two-carbon fragment in your body can't be used for what purpose? What is this pathway that I just moved the arrow? A two-carbon fragment can't be used for gluconeogenesis. What is the fate of this acetyl group? It can only enter the Krebs cycle for energy production. All right, so on this slide, you see that fatty acids can't be used to make sugars. It's impossible. We don't have the enzymes that allow us to do that. So once something is a fat, its fate is only to remain a fat or to be used for the production of ATP. Those are the only two possible fates. All right, and that's because fatty acids are broken down into these two carbon fragments. So that tells me something about another molecule that I had on the board. What was another two carbon fragment that we had on the board earlier today? It was through what yeast can do, alcohol, fermentation. What was the molecule? It had two carbons on it. Oh, you guys just don't know much about it yet. Is ethyl alcohol. Okay, is what? A two carbon fragment. What's the fate of ethyl alcohol in your body? Okay, it's a two-carbon fragment. Can ethyl alcohol be used to make sugars?
No.
You know what?
Yeah.
Look at this right here. Alcohol is a two-carbon fragment. It means it can be converted into an acetyl group. It can be combined with acetyl-CoA to run the Krebs cycle for energy, but alpha alcohol, because it's a two-carbon fragment, cannot be used for gluconeogenesis. Because, look, is this a one-way street or a two-way street here? It's a one-way street. All right, so when you drink ethyl alcohol, what is that like eating?
Sugar.
No. Okay, I'll go over it again. It's like eating a bar of butter. Because, I know, this is why people hate this class. One of the reasons why, okay, because ethyl alcohol is a how many carbon fragments? It's a two-carbon fragment. You can't make a three-carbon fragment from a two-carbon fragment. You see that one-way arrow right there? So when you drink alcohol, the two possible fates is that it can be used to make fatty acids or it can be used for energy. Right? So if you're drinking a beer or other kinds of adult beverages, what should you be doing? Exercising. That's otherwise, what's going to happen to it? It's going to be converted into fat. That's the only possible fate for that ethyl alcohol. All right, so that's just a little biochemistry. So next time, I'm going to start right about in here. Ethyl alcohol can be used for energy via the Krebs cycle, or it can be converted into fatty acids, and that's it. It can't be used to make protein, can't be used to make sugars. Say that again? Ethanol and ethyl alcohol are the same, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.